Yes? As ready as will we be. Okay, this is the series on controversial issues in Judaism. And tonight we are definitely going to be handling a controversial, difficult issue. Oh, great, there are psychologists in the audience. We're going to be discussing tonight homosexuality in the Jewish religion, in Jewish halakha, in Jewish thought. Before I start, just as a preface, this is a topic that's going to require us to talk about things that we don't normally talk about in a shul in front of an Aron Kodesh. If you're uncomfortable with that, you might want to leave. I'm going to have to say words, address concepts. There's no way that I can mince words about the word choice that I use. So I have to, if it offends anybody, I have to apologize at the beginning. But that's just the nature of the topic requires us to talk in a different way than we normally do. It's also a very sensitive topic. I have no doubt that there are people in the room that know people firsthand who are homosexual, or certainly secondhand, you know somebody who knows somebody. And I don't mean like you happen to know a person in the world, like, you know, everybody knows Elton John, right? That doesn't help. But you'll know somebody who, either a family member or a friend. And so this is nogea to, I think, to everybody probably in the room. I want to go at this from a few different directions. We'll start by just laying kind of just the bare bones grounds for the technical aspects of the prohibition in the Torah against the homosexual act. Right? And you'll notice that I've already kind of shoved that in there by mentioning that we're talking about the act. And of course, this is, you know, the I don't want to say celebrated passage, but the well-known passage in Vayikra, in Leviticus, which says, "You shall not lie with a man as one lies with a woman. It is a to'eva." I left the to'eva first as transliterated because there's not really a great translation for the word. But of course, it's almost always translated as an abomination, which I have no idea, you know, what it originally, you know, what the abomination word actually originally meant. But it kind of now has a connotation of just being, I guess, something repulsive, something disgusting, something kind of deviant. And that's just the sense that people take from it. But of course, the word itself, to'eva, is a Hebrew word. And it would behoove us to try it a little bit to figure out what exactly the word means. But before we get to those philosophical underpinnings, which is really the next section, let's talk a little bit more about the technical aspects of the prohibition. So, first of all, the Rambam writes, "One who actively copulates with a male, or one who brings a male upon himself, as soon as the penetrative act has begun, if they are both adults, they are to be stoned." Okay, we'll leave off the stoned part, because it's not relevant nowadays anyways. But you'll notice the Rambam describes the act, which is consistent with what the Torah says. What does the Torah say? Does the Torah say that it's prohibited to have homosexual inclinations, to have tendencies? No, it says if a man lies with a man, as he does with a woman. And there are two things learned from that. Number one, that it refers to the act. But of course, there's another thing that's learned from it, which is that if it's about the act, then it has to be done by people who are capable of doing the act, which excludes half the population of the world, presumably, which is women. Right? Because if it's don't lie with a man as he lies with a woman, so then women can't do that. They can't do what the Rambam describes, right? The penetrative act has begun. That's impossible. That's an anatomical impossibility. So it would seem that the prohibition on a biblical level applies only to men. Clear? That seems pretty clear. I'll address you. Skip to the last source in this section, where the Shulchan Aruch, however, does mention that doesn't mean that everything is fair game. It is forbidden for women to play around with one another. That's kind of again the problems with translation. The Rambam writes the word mesalsalot, nashim hamesalsalot. There's not really any translation for that word, but it seems that it means either to play around or it means, I think that I've seen it translated as to rub against. That's what the Rambam says. Nashim hamesalsalot, they rub against, which is as good a description as you're going to get of what it is that would be possible. So the Shulchan Aruch says it is forbidden. Although such conduct is forbidden, it is not punishable with lashes, since there is no specific prohibition against it and no sexual intercourse takes place at all. Again, as we said, the Torah prohibits men because there is an actual act, the homosexual male act that occurs, which is the same as the heterosexual one, just between two men. And that can't possibly happen between two women, but it's nevertheless forbidden. He says, it is, however, appropriate to subject such women to makat mardut since they committed a prohibited act. Makat mardut is the punishment that's given for violating a rabbinic prohibition. This is just regular punishment that's given. Again, not relevant nowadays. We don't give out these kinds of punishments, but that's the technical aspect of it.
What's the basis for the...
So the Rambam writes this. As I said, he's the one who invented this term, Mesal Salot, which I don't know where it comes from. He bases it, I don't remember exactly whether it was his drasha or whether it was a regular midrash. He says that this is what the Torah means, or the Nanach means, when it says, don't follow after the ways of the, I think it was the Amorites, or it might have just been in general, the nations. He says, that's what they used to do. In other words, that was a common practice, common sexual practice in those ancient times, and that's what you shouldn't do. So that was what he says was the basis for women. But the truth is that if we could just talk about the core is between two men. That's just the core because that's what the biblical prohibition. So I'm going to assume from now on that what we're talking about is between two men, although everything we're saying generally can apply to two women just on a rabbinic level. So that's in regards to the actual act itself. But what if we're not talking about the actual act itself? What if a person says, okay, so I won't engage in the actual act, but everything else before that, that's what I want to do. So, Rav Chaim Rappaport, this is the Green Book, that's what it's called in YU, the Green Book, Judaism and Homosexuality, there's really no other book like it. This is pretty much, in terms of a book, there are lots of articles, but in terms of a book, this is the only one like it. If you want to go out and get it, you can. Rabbi Chaim Rappaport is a British rabbi. I think he's on the Beis Din of Rabbi Sachs. Happens to be Chabad, but he's a tremendous scholar, and he wrote an incredible work with a foreword by Rabbi Sachs, actually. And he has everything on the topic that you could really want. Of course, there are opposing views and differing views that you can find on the internet. You can find them in all different kinds of places. Although I will say with a caveat, and I'll address this again, when we get to the halachic aspect, most of the halachic opinions that you're going to find are going to be all modern. Because the issue just was never an issue, and we'll get back to this in a few minutes, it just wasn't an issue before the 20th century. Nobody was asking the question, nobody was answering the question, just because of the state of outlook, of self-view of, let's say, people who would be, if we could be anachronistic, because that's what it would mean, who would be homosexual back then. They didn't consider themselves that way, so they weren't asking these kinds of questions. So you won't find in halachic literature before the 20th century, maybe you'll find one or two, but you won't really find anything that, as a burning issue. We will see that it's brought, that the act is brought up, but it's not a burning issue until the 20th century. So Rabbi Rappaport writes, in addition to the ban on active homosexual practices, willfully engaging oneself in homosexual fantasy, self-stimulation, masturbation, or voluntary exposure to provocative material would be a violation of Jewish law. These prohibitions are not unique to homosexuality. Okay, that last sentence is essential because nothing he said was unique. In other words, what he said is that anything that a man would do with a woman or a woman would do with a man, those are all prohibited for a man with a man. The Torah says, lo tekrivu legalot erva, right? That you shouldn't come close. The Rambam understands that as a biblical prohibition. The Ramban understands that as a rabbinical, not that, but he says it leads to a rabbinical prohibition of any sexual touch between two people who are not married or who are, prohibited to be married, okay? The Ramban says that's the Ramban, and this would apply to men and women. Shmirat Negiah, mitzvah in the Torah. And so it applies to two men who are trying to engage in some kind of sexual act and fantasy as well. Rav Moshe Feinstein and others learn it from the mitzvah of, the pasuk escapes me. We'll have to leave that for later. The pasuk escapes me right now. But the prohibition of fantasizing about sexuality and leading yourself purposely towards arousal, it would apply equally to two men, or to one man fantasizing about another man, just like any other sexual prohibition. There are other issues. Let's say a person would say, okay, this is where we're getting into a little bit more murky waters in terms of how to write black letter halachic law. What happens if a person says, okay, so fine, so I won't touch them, I won't fantasize about them, but I want to carry on a relationship, I want to have an intimate relationship without sexuality, let's say, right? So what could the halacha possibly say about that? So the midrash in Torah Kohanim, there's a midrash on Sefer Vayikra. It says, and in their statutes you shall not walk. What were those statutes? A man would marry a man, and a woman would marry a woman, and a woman would marry two men, and a man would marry a woman and her daughter. So in other words, this is being defined along the lines of what the Rambam says about two women engaging in homosexual activity. This would be following in the norms of the immoral non-Jews of the time, to actually have some kind of married relationship between two men or between two women. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote this. It's not found in black letter law. It could be because it was kind of just not really on the agenda for Rav Yosef Karo to be writing in the 16th century about two men getting married. It wasn't, don't know whether he would have written it. The Rambam doesn't really address it either. It just may not have been on the agenda. It was kind of unthinkable, right? But nowadays, certainly, in almost all throughout the world, right now burning in America, burning here as well. This is obviously going to be on the table. Okay? So that's in terms of the technical law. There is some discussion, this is getting into a little bit of a deeper halachic issue, in terms of, let's say we assume that a person has confirmed himself as a homosexual, and the person is not going to get married, he's going to attempt to be celibate, right? But if he's going to be celibate, the energy has to go somewhere, it has to be channeled. And so what Rabbi Rappaport writes is about masturbation, right? So what if that's the alternative is either that or actually engaging in homosexual sex? So Rabbi Rappaport writes, obviously, that's going to be, we know what we're going to pick. There's one that's going to be lower than the other, and that's going to be the masturbation is obviously going to be, if we're giving the advice, if they're asking b'chlal, then that's going to be this that's given. It's a tragedy, but that would be the advice that would be given. Okay. So far, so good, awkwardly? Okay, that's fine.
I have a question. Like, if somebody goes to a rabbi and says he's gay and he wants to engage in homosexuality,
right,
he'll be told to masturbate instead?
If the rabbi would be asked, I think any common sense rabbi would be asked, these are the two alternatives. I'm just thinking common sense. Of course, that's what he's going to tell him. He's going to tell him you shouldn't do either.
Yeah.
But if somebody, if they came to you and said, here, there's a biblical prohibition, here's a rabbinic prohibition, right? Or any very, very bad biblical one versus a less bad one, obviously he's going to tell them to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's on a technical level in terms of, one other issue. Yichud. This comes up a lot, right? I mean, it's just, this is kind of an unavoidable one if we don't come up with a way of solving it. So here there's a little bit of good news. So generally speaking, yichud applies only between a man and a woman. Not generally speaking, not fully speaking. It applies only between a man and a woman, a man and a woman that he's prohibited to be with and also is not somebody who he kind of, is used to. Between a man and his mother, there's no problem with yichud. Between a man and his wife, there's no problem with yichud. Between a man and his sister, the minhag, let's say, is that there's no problem of yichud, okay? But between a man and a regular woman, there is going to be a problem of yichud for just one man and one woman, or even two women. You have to have another man or some other kind of shmirah, some kind of guard. So what about between one man and another man? So just in general, let's say between one man and another man. So you would expect that the answer would be that there's no issue, right? Between two men, there's going to be no issue. So it's interesting. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, this is not on your page. The Shulchan Aruch actually writes that Jews are not suspected of a man lying with a man or bestiality. Therefore, there is no prohibition for a man to be alone with another man. However, he does separate himself from another man or animal is praiseworthy. So he's brought it in. He's brought the animal in also. He shouldn't be alone. And great sages of Israel would separate themselves from an animal in order that they should not be alone with it. And in these generations, this is Rav Yosef Karo writing, contrary to what I said before about it not existing, apparently, and in these generations when licentiousness is prevalent, two men should not be alone with each other. This is Rav Yosef Karo, I don't know, writing this in Tzfat, basically, but he had lived in Arab lands, where apparently he felt that it was prevalent enough. Okay? Now, a commentary on, this is not actually on the Shulchan Aruch, but about 100 years later, the Bach wrote, and in these generations, when he quotes the Shulchan Aruch, and he says, and he wrote this according to his country and generation. And it seems that this is the law. However, since this promiscuity is not prevalent in our country, there is no need for a man to separate himself from another man. However, a person who chooses to separate himself is certainly praiseworthy. So, the Bach said it was completely unnecessary to actually engage in this chumrah, right? In this stricture. The Bach said that in Europe, there was no such problem. You'd have to do percentages nowadays. I believe the percentage, you can correct me if I'm wrong, right now is estimated to be between 1 and 5% of people being homosexual. That's what I read online. It's not an authoritative source, but that's what I read. It would seem that we're kind of still in the Bach territory, right? We're still in the Bach territory where it's not nearly prevalent enough for there to be some kind of prohibition between two men being alone in a room together. And so it wouldn't be an issue. But even so, even more than that, though, however, the technical prohibition, though, the Rav Yosef Karo is only writing that there could be a chashash, there could be a chumrah of two men being together in one room. But at the basis, there is no halacha at all. Even if the two men were homosexual, even if one of them was, there would be no yichud. Might be ill-advised. Right? We could advise yichud to the non-Jews. A lot of the U.S. presidents would have gotten out of a lot of trouble if they had only taken that chumrah upon themselves. It's definitely ill-advised, but it's not technically asur, and so it's just simply not something to be concerned about nowadays. Okay. Now I'm going to go on to the next section. The next section is about philosophically speaking, right? So here we get into how the Jewish thinkers throughout the ages approached this prohibition. Okay, so we'll start with the Sefer HaChinuch. In other words, the question is here going to be, why? Why is there such a prohibition? Why is there such a problem with two men lying together? So the Sefer HaChinuch says, God desires that the world that he created be inhabited and settled. Therefore, he commanded us not to destroy human seed by sexual relations with males, for this is indeed a destructive act, since there can be no fruitful benefit of offspring from it. And now everybody's going to ask, new? What about other relationships where, you know, there's not going to be any children? No, at no time in history was that ever more relevant than since the 1960s and the birth control pill, right? In other words, there are vast swaths of married individuals who are also engaging in sexual intercourse with no hope of actually having children. So what about that? So the Sefer HaChinuch was protected from that. He says, not the fulfillment of the mitzvah to honor the conjugal right due one's wife. In other words, there's two mitzvot that are occurring when a man lies with his wife. Number one, that they're fulfilling the mitzvah, or at least trying to fulfill the mitzvah, of pru urvu, of reproducing, that God required. But number two, there is, at the basic level of the marriage, there is an extra mitzvah for them to have relations as well. At least on the man, there is an obligation. So he's fulfilling a mitzvah when he lies with his wife, even if there is no chance and no hope of having children. This was always the case. But the Sefer HaChinuch says that doesn't occur between two men, and it can't occur between two men, because there's not going to be any implication for a man to fulfill his husband, right? That's not going to exist, and so there is no redeeming factor to those relations. So that's what the Sefer HaChinuch says over here. He says, if you could boil it down, he says that the whole point of the relations is to actually create children, and a side point is the mitzvah of pleasuring the spouse, but that doesn't exist by two homosexual men. So that's the Sefer HaChinuch. The Gemara in Nedarim addresses this term of To'eva. A fascinating Gemara. I said before that the word To'eva is hard to translate. It's not just hard for me to translate, it's hard for Rabbi Yehuda Anasi to translate. The Gemara in the Darim says, Ben Elisa, a very wealthy man, was Rebbe's son-in-law, and he was invited to the wedding of Rabbi Shimon by Rebbe. At the wedding, Bar Kapara, there's another Tana, asked Rebbe, that's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, what is meant by Toiva? And every explanation offered by Rebbe was refuted by Bar Kapara. Every time Rebbe tried to explain what the word meant, Bar Kapara said, no, it can't mean that. So he said to him, so you explain it. You're such a, you know, you're going to be such a stickler, so you try to explain it to me. So he replied, interesting, let your housewife come and fill me a cup. He says, you want to hear the answer? You got to pay the toll. So she came and she did so, and upon which he said to Rebbe, arise and dance for me so that I may tell you. He really tried to milk this. Thus said the divine law, Toeva, Toe, Ata, Ba. He says, it's kind of a play on words. Toe, Ata, Ba. What is Toe, Ata, Ba? You stray after it. In it, you stray. Okay, so what he's saying is that homosexuality causes you to stray. What does that mean? What does that mean?
To go wrong.
To go wrong, meaning the etzem, the mitzvah. In other words, you're violating the aveira. So when the Torah says, don't lie with a man, it causes you to violate the prohibition of don't lie with a man. Right? It's a little bit weird.
Where else in the Torah do we use Torah?
That's a great question. I want to get back to it later. Okay. Don't mind. But an excellent question. There are places. So, Rabbi Bleich is a professor and a teacher in YU. He's written many, many books on contemporary halacha. Brilliant man. So he quotes Tosas and the Rosh who explain this term, and they say, the homosexual goes astray in the sense that he abandons his family. In other words, what the Torah was concerned with was that there was going to be this core family, man, wife, children, and another man has no place in that, because two men are not going to have any children. There's not going to be a family, right? So it has to be from outside of the family unit that this is happening. And he says that it causes you to destroy your family unit. If you're supposed to be married and in a family unit, and you're engaging in extramarital sex, even with the same sex, it's going to destroy your relationship with your wife or your wife's relationship with you. And so that's why it's prohibited, because it destroys the family. Obviously, this is, the Tosfos and the Rosh have inserted something in the context of the Pasuk, but they say that's what To'et Abba means, that it causes you to destroy the family unit. So at base, what they are saying is that the problem with homosexuality, the homosexual act, would be that it destroys the family unit.
They don't know what could go on in the 21st century.
What do you mean? What, that they could adopt?
Now people are having homosexuals are having family units.
Right. That's true.
The other side of that is you don't need a homosexual relationship to destroy a family unit.
That's true, but obviously the Torah is trying to say that that this is a really good way to do it. Yeah, it is assuming that.
Whereas nowadays, it's not a valid assumption. Because
right.
Somebody who declares himself homosexual will not willingly or intentionally go into a relationship in most cases.
Right. That's a fair
opposite sex.
It's a fair argument. I guess two responses to that. The first would be that even if this was the reason, of course, we all know that generally we don't change the halakha because of a reason, even if we try to apply the reason. The other thing would be that, okay, the Torah may be saying, we'll have to discuss this a little bit more later, you should have a family. In other words, even if you declare yourself that way, you should nevertheless have a family. Just a possible response that you could give to that. Disagree with that, and we'll talk about it later. Now, here's where things kind of get derailed for most people when they approach this issue. Rav Moshe Feinstein. So Rav Moshe Feinstein is writing this, I think, I wrote it down and it's not here. I believe it's the 1970s. I'm not going to find it now. And it may be before, you might be right. And he was sent a question by a homosexual who wanted to know from Rav Moshe, what should I do? How do I go through the rest of my life? How do I repent? What can I do? Well, this is Rav Moshe's answer. So he says, those who dare ask why the Torah forbids homosexual relations undermine the severity of the prohibition in the eyes of the evildoers who lust for this repugnant indulgence, which is one of the greatest abominations. Even the nations of the world consider that homosexual conduct is unparalleled in its loathiveness. No reason at all is required to explain the abominable nature of the homosexual activity, which is considered repugnant by the entire world, who consider practicing homosexuals to be despicable and uncivilized. Probably the 1950s. No. Let's just strip away the vitriol and the emotional impact of Moshe's comment and just get to what it is that he's actually, you know, technically saying, which is that you don't need to explain the prohibition. Toeva means what you think toeva means. It means it's disgusting. It's repugnant. And it, you know, to the vast majority of the world, that made perfect sense until the 20th century. And it didn't need to be explained. And he says that that's what everybody assumed. And why are we even trying to explain it? And the only reason you need to explain it is because people have perverted it and made it as though it was okay. As though you have to explain why Shabbos is important. You don't have to explain why Shabbos is important, only because there are people who, let's say, don't think that Shabbos is important. That's why you have to explain it. But it's self-evident to Rav Moshe why homosexuality is a toeva in the abominable sense of the word. And so he doesn't even see the need to explain it. Okay?
Question.
Yeah.
I haven't read lots and lots of responses from I've certainly heard any number of them, but I haven't studied them. But I'd be curious to know if this sort of style, it just strikes me as nothing like I'd ever heard any of his responses before.
Oh, that's because you never read him. You never read anything he wrote about conservative and reform.
I have heard some.
Yeah, he didn't pull punches.
So he really gets his dander up against certain topics.
He definitely did not pull his punches. He wasn't, I will say that when he died, the New York Times obituary for him was that he was a refined and well-groomed individual. Very interesting. That's what they wrote. I mean, they said he's a rabbi, they say he's an important rabbi, but that's how they described him, which is interesting. I mean, that's what they cared about. So that's Rav Moshe, and we're going to get back to Rav Moshe later, but that's what he says about the philosophical underpinnings of the prohibition. Now, the Torah Tamima gets back to this idea of Toeh. And he is going to make an argument, which is a scientific one. He says, Nira shahakavana shetoeh midarkei yisodot habri'ah lishkov im hazachar. It's unnatural. Umosif od sham davar acher toeva hi hit'ivu hakatuv yoter min hachamor shehachamor eino ba el al hachamora. Vezeh hit'iv darko yoter min hachamor umin shar kol behemot v'ofot. He's addressing a midrash over there that compares to animals. He says, because the chamor, right, doesn't go on the chamora. Donkeys actually don't procreate, so that makes sense. But what he's saying is that animals don't do it, and so makes sense that human beings won't do it. You won't find an animal engaging in homosexual activity. Their instinct won't allow them to. And so it's unnatural, and kal vachomer for human beings it should be unnatural. And that's why it's toeva. Now, I also Wikipedia'd this. As I'm sure everybody has at some point in their life. And yes, the fact is that modern science, people have noticed that occasionally animals will engage in homosexual activity. I don't know if it's a recent phenomenon. I don't know. But it is the case. It's obviously not, you know, widespread, but it happens. It happens. And it certainly doesn't fit well with evolutionary psychology, but it happens anyways. And so the argument is a little bit dampened by the fact that it happens. The argument could still go as, okay, but those animals, there's something wrong with them. That would be the argument. And so that's why it's considered unnatural. But that's what the Torah Tamim is. He says, Toeva means it's unnatural. Now, Rav Bleich gets us back to the 21st century. And he says, for the vast majority of humanity, homosexual activity is deviant behavior. Meaning, to the non-homosexual, homosexuality is repugnant in the sense that it's weird and it's not something I'm into, and therefore it's unpalatable and unpleasant for me to think about doing it. It is unnatural and repugnant and abomination. To speak of such conduct as losing one's way, going astray, is almost to minimize the infraction. It may not be reading too much into the rabbinic text if it is understood as directed to homosexuals who feel no repugnance regarding their conduct. A person burdened by homosexual orientation goes astray if he believes such activity to be acceptable because it does not appear to him as an abomination. In other words, Rabbi Bleich, in an amazing turn, in light of what many modern non-Orthodox scholars do with the prohibition in Vayikra, Rabbi Bleich actually says that the prohibition, as it's termed in Vayikra, is a modern prohibition. That it refers directly to people of homosexual orientation and doesn't refer to non-homosexuals. Not that it's okay for them, but he says the word to'eva, the prohibition itself, I'll be clear, the prohibition itself across the board. Don't lie with a man as you lie with a woman. But the word to'eva, Rabbi Bleich says, that if it means to'et haba, it's kind of like, it's a little bit, it's been downplayed almost. You astray after it. It doesn't sound so bad. You stray after it. So Rabbi Bleich says, no, because it's talking to people who are oriented that way. Now, this is amazing because the truth is that conservative and reform scholars who try to downplay the prohibition in general, what do they say? They say the exact opposite. They say that the prohibition in the Torah refers, in general, I'll give you one example, refers to abusive homosexuality. It refers because in ancient times, that was how it was typically performed. It was an act of domination on a person. Not so ancient. You know, you go to a my knowledge is only from movies, but you go to institutional organizations like a jail. It's a form of domination, a form of controlling another person or humiliating them. And so that's what many reform and conservative scholars tried to say, that the modern kind of defanged form of homosexual relations is not covered by the Torah because it's totally different. And Rabbi Bleich says the exact opposite. He says, no, to'eva is referring to them because they are led to it. Normal people are not led to it. He says, why would you say it's to'et haba for somebody who has no interest? For 95% of the people in the world, for 95% of their lives, the prohibition is an easy one. It's not. I would never think to do that. It's kind of like, there's prohibitions against eating bugs. So unless you live in China, or in India, in some countries like that, it's really not that hard. I mean, it's hard. We made it hard, but it's hard because they're small. But it's not hard because you actually want to eat them. So it would be strange for the prohibition almost as like an easy one, unless that's what you're into. Then it becomes hard. So that's what Rabbi Bleich argues, which is a very interesting thing. Rabbi Bleich basically just says, it's a blanket prohibition. It doesn't need to have an explanation. It's just a regular prohibition. The to'eva language, which we feel is supercharged, Rabbi Bleich says the exact opposite. He says it's a watering down. It's referring directly to only people who are oriented that way. Okay. Now we get to the 20th century issues. As I was saying before, until the 20th century, there really was no concept of sexual orientation. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be that it was an act, and that's all it was. It was something that some people did some of the time. If you look, yeah.
I think it was a lot more common than it was just kept very, very quiet.
It may have been common. Nowadays, homosexual is something that you are. It used to be that homosexual is something that you sometimes did. Right.
Later, that was what they were, not what they did.
Right. So let me be more precise. There's now a perception, the scientific community and many people, their position is that if you are homosexual, you cannot engage. You wouldn't want to engage in heterosexual activity. That's the way you are, and you wouldn't want to do that. Even those artists that you're speaking of, right? It may have been something that they were into, something they did. But they probably, I don't know how they felt about themselves, but society didn't see them as being that way. They just saw them as doing those things some of the times. Go back to the Torah. The Tanakh doesn't you know, never addresses this concept. It's such a huge concept, you would expect it to address it. Of course, the Tanakh does address homosexual activity. Where does it address it? Just throw out some of them. They're easy. Right? Where's the first one? Well, the first one is that's in the text. Is, well, that's not in the text necessarily. But the first one that's, you know, indisputably in the text, which, you know, the English word Sodom, right? To sodomize comes from Sodom because that's what they wanted to do to the guests, right? That's what they said they wanted to do. It was men that were there. That's what they wanted to do. So are we to presume that everybody in Sodom was gay? I mean, it seems strange. I mean, even if you raise the percentage, it's never going to get there. The amount of people that would have to come to his house to actually threaten him, you know, what's going on over there? You mentioned Noach, it's true. Noach and Cham, there are two views in the Midrash about what exactly happened over there, but that's one of them. So Sodom was another one. The Midrash says that Potiphar, that's what he wanted Yosef for, right? And actually, another Midrash says that this is, I mean, it's funny, but it's not funny. The Midrash puts in Yehuda's mouth, I guess what would be considered nowadays a homophobic slur. When Yehuda goes after Yosef for trying to keep Binyamin, he doesn't know he's Yosef. He doesn't know he's Yosef, right? So Yehuda says to him, "Oh, I know why you want Binyamin. You want Binyamin for the same reason that Paro has all these boy slaves. And we're not going to let you." That's why they offered to stay, because they wanted to protect Binyamin from Yosef, right? That's what Yehuda actually said to Yosef. Now, Yosef was married. He was Sofnat Paneach was married, right? So it doesn't seem like the Torah was accusing him of being actually that way, right? You have in the Tanakh, you have, you know, many, many places in Tanakh that the act itself is described, but never do you get the sense of an orientation. And throughout history, that's the way it's kind of been, that society hasn't really validated the idea that a person could be exclusively homosexual, right? So now let's get to some of the sources in the poskim and in the also mostly in the Achronim. As I said, you won't find the discussion in the Rishonim. You won't find a Rashi that talks about homosexuals. You won't find a Ramban. You won't find even an Or HaChaim or a Beis Yosef. You won't find it because it doesn't exist, because it wasn't on the radar. So, but this is Rav Moshe responding to the same. This is the same tshuva after he said what he said. So he says to speak of a desire for homosexual intimacy is a contradiction in terms. In essence, the wicked also have no desire for this. Rather, the desire is only to do something which is forbidden because it is forbidden. He said, this tshuva from Rav Moshe, it's pretty loaded, but what is Rav Moshe essentially saying? Rav Moshe is saying, even into the 20th century, says there is no such thing as homosexual. The act exists. Some people seem to like it for some reason. But there's no such thing as a person who was born with the inclination only for the same sex. Doesn't exist. Something happened to him. He did something to himself. Moshe says it's all invented in his mind. And obviously, if he wants to, he can get rid of it. If it was invented in his mind. That is Rav Feinstein's position. That is not the mainstream position for most poskim nowadays, at least not that extreme form. Rav Moshe basically just says, cut it out. That's what he's basically saying, right? As though it was that simple. As I said, after that, things kind of changed. Here is the very interesting from the Sichos of Lubavitcher Rebbe. He also addressed this directly. So this is in a response that he was giving to a student. So he says a lot here. I don't read the whole thing, but I'll read some of it. He says, educators, therapists, and counselors should keep in mind that the possibility exists to eventually correct the problems. He was a believer that there was some form of therapy that would be useful. Even though the troubled client might vehemently claim, which might actually be quite true, that his deviations are inborn and part of his nature. So what did Lubavitcher Rebbe just say? He admitted that he could be born with it. He admitted that he could have been born with it. They can be helped, and experience has shown that in the end they will express their eternal gratitude for the firm direction and support they received from family, counselors, and friends. But Lubavitcher Rebbe says that it can be use the word fixed, but that would assume that, right, it's a loaded term. It can be changed, let's just say. The person can be changed, and it sounds like he's saying that he's seen it before, because he says that they have eternal gratitude. And now he's going to explain how. So Maimonides teaches free will is bestowed on every human being. If one desires to turn towards the good way and be righteous, he has the power to do so. If one wishes to turn towards the evil way and be wicked, he is at liberty to do so. That's the Rambam. So he says, consequently, this true free will described by Maimonides is decisively all-powerful. Yet in laws relating to moral disposition and ethical conduct, Hilchos Deos, Maimonides admits that every human being is characterized by numerous moral dispositions, exceedingly divergent. One man is choleric. I have no idea what the Hebrew for that is. I forgot. Always hot-tempered. Another sedate, never angry. So he says, people are born with midot. People are born with inborn, right, tendencies, character traits, right, temperaments. But he says, you can change it. Of all the various dispositions, some belong to one from the beginning of his existence and correspond to his physical constitution. In other words, some people are born with the nature of stinginess, okay? So then the Rambam says, though, that it makes, this is, no, hold on. Right. The Rambam describes how a person can change his, not over here, but the Rambam describes how a person can change his natural inclinations. By, the Rambam specifically says by going all the way in the opposite direction, which makes sense for those things. I don't know if it makes sense for this. But what the Babbage Rebbe is bringing out is from the Rambam is that free will overcomes all. If a person wants to change, he can even change his inborn tendencies. And he's applying it to this as well. So just like you can stop being stingy, you can stop being angry, you can also stop being homosexual. If you really, really wanted to, you would be able to change it. That's how he's reading this Rambam. It makes no real difference what causes an individual to presently choose this form of relationship. Even one who is born with this inclination and was not educated in his youth to correct it, and is now an adult, must also be motivated to educate himself now, for it is still just as destructive as it is still just as abnormal. And he says, an important point to stress is that there is no insult intended, and no derogatory attitude is suggested. It is a case of healing a malady. When a person is ill and someone volunteers to help him get well, there is no disrespect involved, not at all. Just like you would want to cure somebody who has a congenital disease, something that's, a person was born without an arm, you would want to create a prosthetic. If a person was born with a certain condition, you would want to fix it. So this is just like that. And you're not insulting the person by trying to fix it. Many, many, just to play the side of the Babbage Rebbe, many homosexual people who are proud may say, I was born this way, and you're insulting me by saying that I need to change. So the Babbage Rebbe would respond and say, I'm not insulting you at all. If a person was born with a condition that, you know, there was something wrong with them, and I wanted to fix it, is that insulting towards them? Very nice that you were born with it, but we can fix it. We can change it. So he says that there's no insult at all. Okay. So that's the Lubavitch Rebbe's position. You know, a step away from Rav Moshe, basically saying that, you know, it may be a valid feeling. Right? The people are not crazy, and they're also not trying to be bad. Right? It's striking that Rav Moshe would write such a thing to somebody who had actually written to him that he's struggling with it. But he did. But the Babbage Rebbe says, you know, there's something different about you. There's something wrong. But you can fix it. It can be fixed. You can overcome it. That was the Babbage Rebbe's position. Now here, going forward in time, Rav Aaron Feldman. Does anybody know who Rabbi Aaron Feldman is? There's a book over here by him, actually. It's called The River, the Kettle, and the Bird. It's a book on marriage. Yeah, on Shalom Bayis. I think he is presently, or he was 10 years ago, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael, which is a yeshiva in Baltimore, and pretty yeshivish Haredi individual. Pretty Haredi, okay? If he was in Israel, he'd be all the way. In America, we don't really have Haredim, so that's right. They're just different. So, this is a pretty incredible letter, given that context. I'll read part of it now, another part of it is later. So this is also a letter that he's writing to somebody that wrote to him. He says, I believe that the course you have taken is correct. You must refuse to deny your nature as a homosexual, while at the same time refuse to deny your Jewishness. There is no contradiction between the two if they are viewed in their proper perspective. So you are gay, And that's what you are. And there's no denying it. There's no dancing around it. There's no contradicting it. At the same time, you're a Jew. You have to balance both these things. You have to handle it. Judaism looks negatively at homosexual activity, but not at the homosexual nature. Whatever the source of this nature, whether it is genetic or acquired, the Torah does not express any view on the matter, is immaterial. This nature in no way diminishes or affects the Jewishness of a homosexual. He is as beloved in God's eyes as any other Jew, and is as responsible as any Jew in all the mitzvahs. He is obligated to achieve life's goals by directing his life towards spiritual growth, sanctity, and perfection of his character. No less is any other Jew. He will merit the same share in the world to come, which every Jew merits, minimally by being the descendant of Avraham Avinu, and maximally by totally devoting his life towards the service of God. So, Rav Feldman has here completely accepted the premise that this person is fundamentally different than other people. He says, I don't know whether it was because you were born with it. I don't know whether it was because something happened to you. It doesn't matter. And he doesn't even suggest that he tried to change it. And we'll see the rest of the letter later. He doesn't. It's not what he advocates in this letter. He just says, this is the way you are. You need to figure out how to handle it. And he says, the Torah has no view on your nature, on your orientation. It just tells you what you can and cannot do. The next comment is from a Jemri Weider. This is from actually a taped conversation in YU. So I actually transcribed part of this from it. So he just says, after addressing Rav Moshe, he says, from a common sense perspective, I find it virtually inconceivable that someone who grows up in the firm community chooses to be gay. I can't tell you that it's impossible. I can't tell you if it never happens. But such a possibility is highly unlikely. It is hard for me to understand why someone would choose an option that would consign themselves to a life of misery. So he says, it just boggles the mind what Rav Moshe is saying. Why would he choose to be this way? Especially back then. Nowadays already, right, you could get a support group to make yourself feel better, right? But in Rav Moshe's time, if Rav Moshe is right, it was repugnant, it was disgusting, it was vilified. Why would you do it? Unless you felt you needed to.
It's not a choice, though.
So that's what Rav Moshe thinks it is. So when Rav Moshe says that, that's what Rav Weider is arguing. He says, I don't understand what he's saying. Because why would you choose to do that if it was so painful? So of course, it must not be a choice. So what motivates people to say that homosexuality is a choice? So what was Rav Moshe thinking? What bothered him so much that he had to say this? He wasn't stupid. What made him say this? So Rav Weider, and I've seen other people suggest this, he's not making this up. What bothered Rav Moshe was the following. He says, what bothered them is a fundamental question of theodicy. How could God make someone in such a fashion and then mandate that homosexuality is prohibited? So a very, very simple question. Mommy, if it's prohibited, why did God make me this way? It's just, if he doesn't want me to do it, why close off for me every avenue of happiness and pleasure and longevity and not allow me to actually at least get some kind of pleasure for this drive that I have that is so strong? That possibly was what bothered Moshe. And Rav Moshe's response to that was to say, okay, so it must be that God didn't do it. He doesn't do it. He never does it. But Rabbi Weider says, I don't understand the tension. He says, it's a great question. Why does God create people with drives that they cannot use, they cannot fulfill, they can't do anything with? But it's not a new question. It's the same theodicy question that we ask about anything. He says, you could add it to the many questions of theodicy. There are many situations that due to the halachic system, people suffer. Even Borat Tzadik Viralo. You could ask any Tzadik Viralo, why do bad things happen to good people? Why are people born sick? Why are people born with deformities? You could ask that question about anything. Why are people born as mamzerim? Right? The mamzer, person who is born to an illicit relationship, right? He didn't do anything, but the halacha views him a certain way. Another example. Imagine that and the truth is, this is not a great example because God didn't do it, but imagine a person, a Kohen, falls in love with a girl, and then it turns out that the girl is a divorcee. It happened. Or the opposite, really. A girl who's a divorcee falls in love with a man, and this classic story is that he's a Baal Tshuva, and then he finds out that he's a Kohen because he didn't know it first. Those are rock in the hard place situations where you can't really get out of them. There are many of them. This is one of those. Rav Weider says, and this is what Rav Feldman is saying, that you have to figure out how to deal with it. You have an inclination. You have a desire to do something. And you're not allowed to do it. There are many people with those kinds of desires. Many people can be born with all kinds of psychological conditions that make them want to do things that are against the Torah. In fact, everybody is born with psychological inclinations, right? I'm always struck by this. I think there's an assumption here that that the homosexual drive is somehow stronger than the heterosexual drive. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know whether it's true or whether it's not true, or whether it's an issue of just pent-up energy. I don't know what it is, but there seems to be some kind of assumption like that. But everybody is born with sexual drives, and that can lead you to do something that can be prohibited. So that's how Rabbi Weider addresses this point. Now, again, getting back to the orientation issue, in R.J. Jijer, one of the scholars there says, it seems clear from this that halakha never viewed the homosexual as a member of a unique category. There is no category of homosexual in halakha. This is what I've been saying since the beginning. He has no greater or lesser rights or obligation. He deserves no special treatment or concessions, nor any special vilification. In fact, the term homosexual is an essentially inappropriate description for him. We should rather refer to this individual as a person engaged in homosexual activity, because there's no such thing in halakha. Not talking about psychology, not talking about human nature. We're talking about a halakhic category. There's no halakhic category for hockey players. It doesn't exist. They don't get a special status, right? There's no halakhic category for, well, there is maybe for lefties. I was going to say there's no halakhic category for lefties, but there might be. There's no halakhic category for computer programmers. It doesn't exist. You know, there's many things in life where there's no special category. Why would we expect that this would be a special category? There's just the act. So he says, the first effect of this changed conceptualization is to alter and improve the individual's perception of himself. If one is labeled and defined by the term homosexual, he's consequently different than the heterosexual. As such, he will struggle for minority status and for his rights as a member of that minority. He is and should be portrayed as a unique character type in movies, theater, and television, and he should command an appropriate number of participants in any institution that constitutes itself along racial, ethnic, and religious lines. In society, he should be equal. He should be proportional. He agitates for gay pride and gay power, and if he is Jewish, he creates gay synagogues and other gay institutions. This is what happens if you make it into its own category. If you make it into its own category, then I'm all of a sudden either a heterosexual Jew or a homosexual Jew. And there's no need for that. Once you have that, well then, birds of a feather flock together. They're going to, you're hanging out with them, and we'll hang out with us, and that's not good. That's not good. We'll get to that later. So, he says, on the other hand, if a homosexual is a term that is limited to the description of activity, then the individual practicing remains an undifferentiated member of society. And if Jewish, he is part of the Jewish society. In the same way, I'm skipping, in the same way that the adulterer, the practitioner of premarital sex, the Mechalel Shabbat, or the speaker of Lashon Hara, notice who's all gathered all together over there, all enter the synagogue and feel at home, while individually dealing with whatever guilt they carry as a result of their sinful activities, so too the individual involved in homosexual activity can and should enter the synagogue and feel himself to be part of the community. We're going to get back to this in the next part. He is still a human being and a Jew. He is most assuredly not part of a separate homosexual society or sub-society. Obviously, the adulterer and Mechalel Shabbat are duty-bound to change their ways, and the Mu'min L'Mishkav Zachar has the same obligation. You should try to change your ways. He's not telling them to change their orientation. He's telling them to change their ways. Right? So,
who wrote that in the RJJ journal?
His name is Rabbi Barry Frundel.
Oops.
And one of his books is over there. Before we go on, there's one source that I didn't get to put on the page. This is a pretty amazing source. Rav Kook. This is already at the beginning of the 19th century, so it's not on the source sheet. Rav Kook does write about homosexuality in at least two places, and I'll read to you one of them.
Which Rav Kook?
The
grandfather. All right. So he says, I'm going to read the English, which is, you know, there's nothing the same as the Hebrew. And by that, I mean, I never understand anything he says in Hebrew. So, I'll tell you funny. I mean, when I was in my previous job in HP, so we used to have a chabura on Thursdays, and different people would give the shiur on different each week. So whenever I would give the shiur, very often Rabbi Soloveitchik would come up. And there was another guy who wasn't Israeli, but I guess he learned in a lot of Israeli yeshivas. So whenever he would give the shiur, he would always quote Rav Kook. So I said to him, you know, it's nice to learn it with you because I never understand anything he says. I never understand anything Rav Kook says. He says, well, that's a good thing because I like learning with you because I never understand anything Rabbi Soloveitchik says. It worked out. So, but here's the English. It's also hard in English. The arousal of the new science concerning the natural inclinations that some men have from their conception, and on account of this, they want to uproot the ethical protest of this. He's referring to homosexuality. In other words, he says, there is the new science, right? Basically, the scientists of his day were already saying that homosexuality was something that was inborn. And they want to, based on that, they want to say, there's no reason to be worried about it if it's inborn. So he says, the word of our God will stand forever. Already Bar Kappara interpreted in this regard, to'eva, to'e ata va. Right? For it is an evil inclination which man, individual and collective, must combat. That small amount of desire that might be found in an individual, which is ineradicable, was foreseen by the sages. Okay, so we have to be careful here. He's saying there may be some inborn inclination that a person has, and it may be that it can't even be gotten rid of. And he says an amazing thing now. He says, and the rabbis saw this, and what did they do about it? So he says, regarding it, they said, whatever a man wants, it is comparable to a fish which comes from the fish market. If he wants, he eats it fried. If he wants, he eats it boiled. What does that mean? So what it means is he says that a man with his wife can do whatever he wants. They can do whatever they want together. There are no rules at a basic level. There are no rules, anything they want to do. And he says, thus they plumb the depths of human nature to the point of compassion on those perverted from birth. So he says, the rabbis said this. He claims to allow men who add homosexual urges to at least, assuming that the urge is merely anatomical, to channel their energies in a regular heterosexual marriage and not do it in homosexual marriage. This is unprecedented. I've never seen anybody say anything like this. And he says, he continues, however, that the rabbis do discourage it. Right? In general, the act itself, that form of sexuality, that, you know, that position is very categorically discouraged. But he says, but min hadin, the rabbis permitted it, and he says they permitted it for the sake of those who actually had that desire. Pretty amazing thing. And this is Rav Kook claiming that that went back all the way to the times of the Talmud, at least. A pretty amazing thing. And he also acknowledges, like some of the other people that we've seen, that it was something inborn, it may be something that's ineradicable. Something that they can't get rid of, something that can't be fixed. Now, with regards to the fixing, before we get to the next part, there are many organizations. They're called ex-gay organizations, which are not exclusively Jewish, but some of them are, which attempt to perform therapy. I think to say that the results are mixed, I think is an understatement. One just closed down, Jonah, which is... What?
I think that if I read that
they
were full, I mean,
it was by law that they had to close. Yeah, it was closed down. They were sued. They were sued for like a paltry sum. It wasn't even like... If the allegations are right, and there's no reason to think that they aren't, I mean, what they did was more abominable than anything that the Torah mentions. It's being shut down as we speak, I think, completely. And I listened and I read some of the accounts online from some of the people that went through it. There were these retreats that they would go on, and they would have them stripped naked and do certain things. And to me, it sounded like it was almost making the problem worse than making it better. I don't know whether all organizations are like that. I don't think that they are. And there are many people that claim that they've been cured. And I don't know if there's any reason to argue with them. I have no idea. I think, and here I'm doing armchair psychology, which is always dangerous with a real psychologist in the room. I'll say the following. I might as well say it now. It seems to me that there's a spectrum. It seems to me that there's a spectrum. There are people who are on one side of the spectrum who have no interest at all. Then there are people who are on the other side of the spectrum completely, who have no interest in heterosexual activity. And then there are people who are kind of in between, and, you know, all over the spectrum. The people who are in between obviously can be helped. I don't know if you can get rid of the inclination, but they can at least engage in regular heterosexual marital relations, and they should be encouraged. That seems to be a pretty common sense perspective. I will say, if you argue with the spectrum theory, There's a book by Dan Ariely, which I've quoted before, Predictably Irrational. Again, I apologize from the beginning about the graphic nature of this shiur, but I don't see how I can't mention this study that he did. He did a study where they wanted to study the effect of arousal on decision-making. All kinds of arousal was the idea, meaning it could be anger, it could be happiness, it could be anything, and it could be sexuality. So what he did was he went to a college campus, nowhere better to go when you want to do experiments like this, and he gave them laptops, and he told them that they should reach a state of arousal, and then he wants them to take a survey. So the survey asked them a series of questions about what they would be willing to do in their current state. And they started off innocuously enough, you know, to be with the opposite sex, to do this with the opposite sex, to do this with whatever, to do whatever, all kinds of with more risque issues. And then the question started to lean a little bit more to the deviant, right? With the same sex, with an animal, with this. Now, they had the people take the survey before they started, and then they had them take it again during. Spoiler alert. The disparity was shocking. People were willing to do things in a state of arousal that they never would have been willing to do or thought they would be willing to do in a non-state, including what I mentioned. Now, to me, that says that people can be aroused, and they can do things that they don't expect to do. There's a Musar Vort in this, obviously, in terms of Yichud, in terms of all kinds of Gidarim. But I think one of the points that comes out from his study was that you don't know what's inside of you. And so you don't know what's inside of other people. And there seems to be this kind of this spectrum. Now, practically speaking, okay, something that's more important than the actual sources on the sheet. I was listening to a shiur by Rav Arye Leibowitz, one of the more popular rebbeim on YU Torah, and he described the following scenario that it didn't happen to him, but it happened to a fellow colleague. He says, it was Rosh Hashanah, two-day Rosh Hashanah, obviously, and it was an out-of-town community in America, not one of the New York, New Jersey, out-of-town, small community, everybody knows everybody, everybody knows everybody's business. And one of the families there had a son who came out of the closet. Grew up completely from, came out of the closet, now decided that he was going to be fully homosexual, went and married a man. Non-Jewish man. Now he decided he wants to come home for the holidays. So he comes home, the family is trying to maintain a connection with him, and he comes home, and he decides, it's Rosh Hashanah, I want to go to shul. So this young man, we'll call him Sam, and his husband, we'll call him Luke. Sam and Luke. Luke decides that, you know, this is really important to Sam. So Luke also wants to go to shul. So Sam and Luke go to shul on Rosh Hashanah, and they're sitting there. Now, it can't get any worse, right? Sam's last name is Cohen. And so on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, Sam goes up to Duchen, because that's what he do. All the people are murmuring to each other. Nice out-of-town American Yiddish accents. What's going on? But nobody's doing anything. The rabbi is just standing on the side, not doing a thing. The next day, Sam goes up again. Now people are just apoplectic. Some people are walking out. Some people are, how could this happen? What are you doing over here? No, somebody has to do something. What happened there? You're the rabbi. Go play the rabbi. What would you do in this situation?
How's it worse from somebody that does other things that are wrong? From somebody who's been unfaithful or who's done... There's many other things.
Yeah, was everybody else talking? That everyone,
yeah. So you do nothing. So do nothing.
How they sin. Most other people sin without others knowing.
Right.
Do you give a cherem to a man who doesn't give his wife a get?
That's a general question.
It's the same thing. If he's a Kohen, do you allow him to go up and duch them?
Or if he's not Shomer Shimon, does he go up and
the guy that drove?
Great question. Great. So I think if I could summarize everything, it's no worse than any other prohibition in the Torah, and we don't seem to do anything against any other prohibition in the Torah. At least not nowadays. We don't. Is that what?
Let God be the judge.
Fine. Is that the general? That seems to be the general consensus over here. So, Rabbi Beller agrees with you. And I also agree. Certainly in terms of duchening. Duchening is an interesting thing because there are kohanim we won't let duchen.
Right?
Ranging from the very simple, when Jason Glick broke his arm, he couldn't duchen. That's obviously. But also then there's the married to a grusha, cannot duchen. Now that's why not?
Because that goes against the kahuna.
Good. Excellent. So marrying a grusha creates chalalim, creates children who are not going to be kohanim, can't duchen. And so it's obviously something that is pogea. It affects his kahuna. Right? And so that's going to be what prevents him from duchening. But there's nothing in there about being with a male. Right? And just like there's nothing in there about being with a married woman. It's terrible. It's wrong. Or mechalal Shabbat. Or anything else. Right. What about getting an aliyah la Torah?
They cut out everybody who'd ever done anything
wrong. The Baalei Lashon Hara. The Baalei Lashon Hara should also not be allowed to go up there.
Amen.
And so it would seem that there's not really anything, and this is what, by the way, what Rabbi Prendel was suggesting, is that there's no reason to exclude them from anything.
He's turn around to his congregation and say, let all of you with no sins talk a lot.
Correct.
And let everyone else be quiet.
Right. Another thing that Rabbi Leibowitz said, this might be a little bit more complicated, maybe it's not any more complicated, is what happens, whether or not you agree with the rationale, you can't argue with the complicated nature of the situation. One rabbi commented to Rabbi Leibowitz and says, my greatest fear nowadays is that it didn't happen today, it didn't happen yesterday, but it could happen tomorrow or the next day. The principal of a yeshiva. So one of these days, a couple of men are going to come to my shul, are going to come to my school, and they're going to want to enroll their completely Jewish child, completely Orthodox Jewish child in the school. And no matter what I do, I will lose half of the school, half of the community. Half of them will agree with me, half of them will disagree with me, no matter what I do. There is no good answer. There's no good answer for me. I will say that this is not the same question. I know for a fact that Rabbi Schachter was asked a similar question. There were two men in New York who kept 612 mitzvahs, and they wanted to adopt the child and enroll the child in Ramaz. The principal of Ramaz was Rabbi Lichtenstein, so he came to Rav Schachter to ask what he thought. So Rav Schachter said he didn't think, he said absolutely not. He said because there's no reason to adopt the child. Okay, normally when we adopt child, when Jews adopt children, we adopt non-Jewish children because Jewish children are too expensive. And then that's part of the reason. That's not the whole reason, but that's part of the reason. That's what we do. We adopt the non-Jewish and then we convert them and then. He says, why convert a non-Jew into a, at least currently, a society that will, no matter, that will cause problems for him, that will bully him, that will ostracize him? That's just the reality of the situation. He says, why create that kind of situation? That was his position.
And if it was a child who was already adopted and converted?
Right, that was the other question. Right, that was what this rabbi was worried about. So Rav Schachter wasn't answering that question. He was answering a different question. He was answering whether or not they should adopt to begin with. You can see that as a general question. Should two men adopt and create that family unit? So Rav Schachter says, just based on the psychological reasons, no. That's what he was saying.
But you could have a situation where you have two Jewish women in a relationship.
You'd have the same issue.
Right. Well, the thing is that any child would be a naturally born Jewish child.
If it's in
Hebrew. It's not about whether or not the child is Jewish. The child could be Jewish. What Rav Schachter was saying is that
two men, you're saying adopt a child and convert him for what?
Right.
But if you're talking about two women...
So why shouldn't they just bring a life into the world?
The child is Jewish, however they've done it.
Born from me.
Yeah.
Okay. Could be.
So then you have a more difficult question.
Right. So if they came to the rabbi and said, should we have an implanted child in our family unit? Don't know what his answer would be. Don't know. Probably the answer would be no, because the woman has no obligation, but I don't want to.
But those men do.
Those men do, but this is a bad idea. Well, okay, so good. So you know what? So let's get to that part, practically. Oh, no, that's actually guidance. But I don't know if we're going to have so much time, so why don't we jump into that part? What do we tell the homosexual? Getting back to Rabbi Feldman. So what should he do? What should he do? If therapy is not going to work, or he's not willing to engage in it, what are his options? So here, this is the amazing letter of Rabbi Feldman. You can imagine what kind of impact this had in his yeshivish Haredi circles when he wrote this. So he says, family, it's worth reading the whole thing. Family and children are important in Jewish society, but one who does not have these need not feel that he is not a full-fledged member of the community. The verse in Isaiah, which is read by Jews all over the world on every public fast day, is addressed to the homosexual. Okay, that's a little bit too much, but I don't think he meant it that way. Let not the saris... Okay, actually, he didn't mean it that way. Let not the saris say, I am a dried-up tree. A saris is a person... A saris is someone who has been castrated or who has been sterilized. Castrated, really. Let the person not say, I am a dried-up tree. For so says the God... to the Sarisim, who keep my Sabbath, who choose what I desire, and who keep my covenant, I shall make them in my house and within my walls a monument, a shrine, superior to sons and daughters. I shall render their name everlasting, one which will never be forgotten. So he says, can an homosexual be expected to live as a celibate? I believe a Jewish homosexual can accomplish this if he decides that the Jewish people is his wife and children. It is possible to do this if he throws his every spare moment into devotion to the welfare of his people. There are many areas where he can do this. Because he does not have a family, a homosexual can make serious contributions to Judaism which others cannot. For example, bringing Judaism to smaller communities where there are no facilities for raising a Jewish family. I know of a case where a rabbi successfully inspired the Jews of an entire city for over 40 years because, for various reasons, he never married. They say a similar thing about Lubavitcher Rebbe, that he would not have had nearly the impact that he did if he had children. Didn't have any children. His Hasidim were his children. Since there were no religious schools in town, the rabbis who had held his pulpit before him all moved away when their children had to start going to school. But this rabbi, because he had no family, stayed on and had a major impact on the entire city. Activities involving much travel, such as fundraising, a vital aspect of Jewish survival, is best accomplished by someone who is not tied down to a family. I know of a homosexual who helped establish several important institutions through his fundraising, personally, and is grateful for the irritation which freed him to make his contribution. This was probably 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Not that long ago.
But nowadays things are different to 10 years ago.
No, I mean...
Nowadays, I don't know how many gay couples were having kids 10 years ago, but now it's much more...
Popular. It's not an option. That's not an option, because there's no gay couple in his worldview. In any Orthodox Jewish worldview, there's not going to be a couple. They're homosexuals, and Rabbi Feldman is trying to deal with what should they do, right? He's telling them that they can't engage in the homosexual act. They're not going to be able to get married. That's not an option. And he's saying, on the other hand, I understand that you can't change, and you never will. So what are your options? So first he's saying, marry the Jewish people. Engage in, just throw your whole being into trying to improve the Jewish community. It is no accident that homosexuals are generally more sensitive to the needs of others and to matters of the spirit than are the rest of the population. So here he's going on an amazing track over here. He's basically saying that even this can be channeled into a positive direction. Right? Every midah, as my wife likes to say, every midah. And if you believe the Lubavitcher Rebbe that this is just a midah, just like every other midah that the Rambam mentions, every midah that a person has can be channeled towards a positive direction. So he's claiming that the fact that this person is not tied down, that the fact that this person could be more sensitive than other people, that may actually help them in other ways. That was his position. On the next page, Rabbi Hillel Goldberg speaks to those both to the homosexual and to the community. He says, ultimately, a person was responsible for his every violation of the norm, no matter how profound the drive to violate it. You're responsible. Ultimately. Period. In the meantime, God measures each violation of the ritual, ethical character, and attitudinal norm not only and not even primarily against its objective magnitude, but against the magnitude of the subjective struggle necessary to prevent it. He says, it may be that these people are born with a greater drive, or at least with a drive that they can't fulfill, and therefore it becomes pent up. But he says, l'fum tsa'ara agra. The reward is according to the pain. It just means that every moment that they spend abstaining is more powerful. And it's more powerful than anything that a heterosexual married person would have because they don't have that pain. The stronger the inherent drive toward the violation, the greater the divine mercy toward the violator. The weaker the inherent drive toward the violation, the more severe the divine judgment of the violator. Because those who don't have any drive and yet still indulge themselves, that's much worse than a person who has a tremendous drive and only occasionally indulges. And this is by far my favorite line of all the sheets. I read this line and I started laughing in my house, and my in-laws were there, and they said, what are you laughing at? I said, I'll explain later. We have heard that the revered Ravaran Soloveitchik, when asked his thoughts on homosexuality, replied, you have to read it in the accent and slowly, because otherwise it doesn't get the effect. It is terrible. It is almost as great a sin as cheating in business. Jeremy, here's the answer to your question. Toeva comes up at least 3 times in the Torah, and one of those is cheating in business, using dishonest weights. Toeva. And yet, I haven't seen anybody try to stop, you know, a dishonest businessman from trying to get an aliyah, from duchening, from anything. Right? But it's also called the Toeva. And we can understand it much more than this. Getting back to that for 1 second, Toeva. So my own take on the Toeva, Toetaba, which came to me today as I was listening to something, is that when you look at the examples, and just take the cheating in business and the homosexuality, when you look at those examples, each one of them can be seen as a corruption of a certain Jewish value, of something that God gave us, that he wants us to do something with it, and we corrupted and we went in the other direction. So cheating in business, God gave you money, God gave you a business, God gave you the means, resources, and then you're taking it and it's almost like mi'ilah. Mi'ilah, you know what mi'ilah is? Mi'ilah in halakha is when you take something kodesh and you misappropriate it. It's a misappropriation. You take the sexual drive and you misappropriate it, use it for something that you weren't meant to use it for. It's there for procreation and you used it for something else. The money is there for improving the world, for making more money, and you take it and you just abuse it. Use it for something you're not supposed to use it for. To'eh ataba. I want to finish with two other real-life examples. I mentioned already, and I'm sure that all of you have real-life examples. This one is pretty close to home, and I want to get to it last. The other one is even more close to home. A friend of mine, actually, about 3 years ago, his brother came out of the closet. A friend that I grew up with. My entire life I knew. And his brother is about probably 6 years younger than me. No, less. 4 years younger than me, about. And the whole family is from, and he also, he at this point right now, he's engaged to a non-Jew named Chris. That's not a made-up name. And I called him, and I said, you know, I just wanted to talk to him in general, also about this. I said, you know, what was the family's reaction? So he said the family's reaction was they were shocked, but they're trying their best to, you know, make the best of the situation. At the time, he didn't have a fiancé. He just told him that he was homosexual. That's all he said. He said he tried to help his brother. So he tried to talk to him about it. His brother wasn't open to it, so he stopped. He said, the hardest part about it, this is very interesting, the hardest part about it was that he brought a non-Jewish boy home. I was amazed. I said, what do you mean? He said, if only he had brought at least a Jewish boy home. Jewish guilt knows no bounds. But no joke. What do you mean? How could you? What's the difference? So he said, look, he came over for the Pesach Seder, and you know, it's not just that, you know, we disapprove of it, but you know, there's this non-Jew sitting there, we're saying Shvoch Hamascha LaGoyim, And he doesn't understand us. He doesn't relate to us. And it's just another foreign element. And he said, but worse than that, amazing. Worse than that, if it at least had been a Jewish boy, it would have shown that he wants to stay Jewish, but he has this drive. In other words, he wants to stay a Jew. He has this thing that he needs to do, but he wants to stay in the world. He says, but he doesn't. He has no interest in staying. He has no connection at all to anything anymore. I said, he doesn't care. He doesn't care. And my friend said to him, you know, there are Jewish gay communities. There are synagogues where you can go to, where they're all. I think it's a bad idea. They should not have that. They should all be together. It just causes problems. But he says, if you want to feel comfortable, you can go there. Didn't want to. Wasn't interested. He says, that was really just a symbol. So he says, above and beyond that, it was the fact that he married a non-Jew. That was the biggest problem. Presumably, yes. I don't think he was concerned with that. He wasn't concerned with that. The final thing that I wanted to show you is this letter. So, there's no Lashon Hara here. These names are out in the open. There was a man named Rabbi Alan Stadnauer. He was a principal in the high school that I went to. He was a principal when I was there. He taught some of my friends Gemara. He was a Gemara teacher as well. And in 2003 or 2005, I don't remember which one it was. He came out of the closet. He left the school. He wasn't married, obviously. He wasn't married. Basically, what I heard was he got tired of turning down dates, turning down offers for shiduchim. It was more than just getting tired, but he had enough, and he left the school. I don't know whether he was forced to leave the school, whether he wanted to leave the school. I have no idea. But a few months later, because he left over the summer, so people didn't even know about it until the next school year, a student actually wrote an email to him. The spelling mistakes or typing is not mine. This is how the letter was written. So he says, it's the interested in student, your former student from class 406, now 207. If you didn't go to Flatbush, you won't know what that means. That's the name of the class that he was in. I wanted to know how everything is now that you've left Flatbush. We miss you. I also wanted to ask you a question that's personal, so you don't have to answer, but I'd appreciate it because I've been hearing rumors that you've come out in the open to say that you're gay and that you're not so religious anymore, and I have nothing against the gay part if it's true, but I don't understand how you could give up your religion that easily. If you could please answer. So Rabbi Stadmeyer writes, it's always nice to hear that I'm missed. Thank you so much for the courage to ask. It's fine and not too personal. No matter, by the way, Rabbi Stadmeyer writes at the bottom. I took it out, but he writes at the bottom, if you want to share this with other people, you can. So this is on the internet. So he says, I'm still the same person who is willing to answer, talk about anything in class. I hope other students have the guts as well. As to the rumors, they are true. I appreciate your understanding about my coming out, and I think that your question is very well placed. The truth is that nothing was easy, nor am I certain that I have given up my religion for good. When I decided to step down from the principalship just over a year ago, it gave me a chance to rethink my whole life, something very few people ever do. I have to say, this person was... I wasn't in his class, but my friends who were, he had a tremendous impact on their lives. He was a very, very deep thinker. He took everything seriously. And he was a rabbi. He taught Gemara. He was inspirational. Really was. You remember that I always continuously explore and think and question. So I continued some personal questions I had many, many years before that I put aside because of what it meant to be a rabbi and a teacher. But they were just that, questions, not rejections or disbelief. When I reopened the questions, I found that I was very comfortable with the idea that mitzvot are a crucial way to approach God, and one that within the careful language of my classroom, one that I did and would now encourage students to explore fully. However, increasingly, I had deep doubts I could not resolve for myself about their role in my life. Now, there are many issues I was considering. The role of women in Orthodoxy, do I trust the authority of most rabbis? But I also had to think about how the Orthodox community would accept me as a gay man, meaning he already knew. Honestly, I think most kids I know would be okay. Most adults would not. YouTube confirms this, by the way. They show kids, when they tell kids, oh, this person is, you know, the kids don't care. They just don't care. Given how alone I've been all my life, I just couldn't see fighting an uphill battle just to remain lonely in the Orthodox community. So for now, I'm re-exploring my spirituality and religiosity just more slowly, without preconditions, and with the hope of integrating my whole life and beliefs together. I still believe in the value and truth of Torah, even if I don't feel bound by halakha. And I may yet return to it later. Either way, I still believe deeply that a person must first know their own tradition deeply from the inside before they can start exploring the stuff. So I've always and still do believe that kids should pursue Talmud Torah and Shmirat Mitzvot. Okay. He says at the bottom that he's going to do exactly what Rabbi Feldman said to do. He's traveling all over the world. That's what he's going to do with his time. I'm sure he had a lot of money left over because he wasn't married. He wasn't spending anything. Yeah.
Do you not find it terribly sad that he's lost his religion?
So I don't know whether he's lost his religion. He doesn't think he has.
No, but that somebody like this, because they are homosexual, they feel like they have to, that they lose
it's,
their religion as well. Is that
terribly
I find
sad.
That tragic.
It's terribly sad.
The rabbis of today that have to ensure that people who are gay don't lose their religion as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, 100%. I think that goes back to the letter that Rabbi Feldman wrote and what he was trying to say, trying to find a positive way to channel it, a positive way to approach the issue.
But he wasn't leaving room for them to, yes, be in a homosexual relationship.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't.
No, absolutely not. I don't think outside of conservative halakha, you won't. Outside of, until like 2 years ago. Outside of conservative halakha, you would never find such a thing. And even now, you know, there's the Open Orthodoxy movement. Rabbi Greenberg performed at a homosexual civil ceremony. But aside from him, I don't think anybody would, at least at the moment, would ever do that. Of course, it's extremely tragic. It speaks to his character that he addresses it that way, meaning he himself is pained by it. Think about this. He knew this, and yet he continued to teach children, right? And I'm not saying that in a lewd way. I'm saying there were never any accusations of anything. He continued to teach children Torah Judaism, despite the fact that he had these doubts, because he believed that it was the right thing. There was something called the Statement of Principles that came out 5 years ago, 2010, which was signed by many rabbis, which is not on your sheets, but basically tries to state orthodox principles, which include the fact that every human being is born B'Tzelem Elokim and needs to be treated as such, which includes the fact that homosexual activity is prohibited, but that homosexual orientation, there's nothing wrong with it. They don't know what causes it. They don't know whether it can always be cured. But that can't be decided. But the prohibitions of homosexuality that I mentioned at the beginning, touching, performing the act itself, having that kind of relationship in general, that it's prohibited. And it's a tragedy and it needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be dealt with openly and not just secretly. That's what the Statement of Principles is. It's signed by a lot of rabbis whose names you probably know. There's some rabbis who didn't sign it. There was a competing, it's an interesting thing. I'll end with this. There was a competing declaration that was going around the more yeshivish Haredi community in America for sure. I don't know whether it made it to Israel. That was also being signed. And I haven't seen it. I don't think you can just get it. But basically, what it suggested was that it exists, not like Rav Moshe, that it exists, but it can be fixed. And that it unequivocally can always be fixed. The person behind it, I've read afterwards, the person behind the declaration has actually since recanted that view and said that he thinks that not always can it be fixed. It very often can, but that it not always can be fixed. And so that seems to be kind of where things stand right now. I'll take your question after. I hope that this has been as edifying for you as it was for me. And I think it's important to address these things kind of head on, even in, especially in a Beit Midrash.
We're looking at things, historically speaking, in a much more advanced stage now than if you'd have given this shiur.
I couldn't have given this. 10 years ago, maybe. 40 years ago, this wouldn't have been a conversation.
In the same way that at the end of the 19th century, things were illegal. Right. And people like
Alan Turing,
Oscar Wilde, were vilified and jailed for this. But we're looking at it from another century on.
Alan Turing.
And in another century or another 50 years,
we may look at it differently.
The Rabbonim might have to look at things.
You never know. You never know.
In England, there was an Orthodox rabbi who had to leave Orthodoxy,
right,
presumably because of the reaction of other Orthodox rabbis.
Right.
So he had to become reform or conservative or whatever it was.
But things have changed throughout history, and as the Lubavitch Rabbi says, God's will remains eternal. So, I presume that something. But you don't have to go there. Alan Turing was one of the people responsible for perhaps single-handedly winning World War II.
Yeah.
And 2 years after the war, he was jailed. Or no, he wasn't jailed. He committed suicide. No, he took pills. And he committed suicide.